You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This is The Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. Tanya Selvaratnam's doctor told her she still had time to have a baby after she had her first miscarriage at the age of 37. That turned out not to be true for her. She had two more miscarriages over the next 3 years. Ms. Selvaratnam tells her story and sorts through a lot of conflicting messages about delayed pregnancy and fertility in her new book. It's called The Big Lie: Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. It's published by Prometheus, and she's here with us today. Welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show, Tanya.
Thank you for having me.
So you are wading into some very emotional territory here with this book about fertility, and you went with this very blunt title, The Big Lie. What's the big lie, and who's telling it?
Well, in the book, I deal with the many big lies that we are told and also the ones that we tell ourselves. And one of the big lies is that we can do things on our own timetables. And another big lie is that we can manipulate evolution. And another big lie is that we don't need feminism anymore. So the basic premise of the book is that biology does not bend to feminist principles and that science cannot work miracles. And I explore how delaying motherhood intersects with the various aspects of our lives: evolution, popular culture, female friendships, global economics.
So there are some very personal consequences for those big lies in terms of decision-making about when to have children. We'll get to those in just a minute, but I want to open this up to listeners. We want to hear your stories about dealing with childbearing and age. Call in with your stories or questions for Tanya Selvaratnam. The phone number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. And we're not just going to talk about childbearing and conception. We also want to hear the experiences of older parents. If you were able to conceive later in life, what's it like to have kids growing up when you're a little older? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's start with the data, Tanya. So you are a writer and an artist and a producer, not a doctor, but that created this nice, I felt like I was coming along with you on this journey of figuring out what was actually true and what was not true. What's the data about fertility rates and age in women?
Well, I started writing the book after my third miscarriage in the fall of 2011. And the reason I started writing it is because I was frustrated not so much by the lack of correct data, but by the conflicting messages that were out there about the impact of delaying motherhood on fertility. And the one thing that was very clear is that I looked around to friends of mine who were successful in having kids in their late 30s and early 40s, and I thought, oh, I can be them too. But then when it didn't work out for me, it sent me on this investigation of what the data actually was. And of course, the data supports that as we age, our eggs age too, and the likelihood of miscarriage and infertility does increase. Of course, there's many, many statistics that show that women can still get pregnant in their late 30s and early 40s, but we have to balance those optimistic scenarios with the heartbreaking ones, and that's what I hope to do with the book.
And let's talk specifically about age. I mean, women have lots of different experiences and lots of different individual fertility sort of issues, but what typically happens at 30? What happens at 35? What happens at 40?
Well, we're born with a finite number of eggs, about 2 million at birth, and those eggs decrease as we get older. So by the time we start our first period, we might have 300,000 to 400,000 eggs. By the time we're in our 40s, we have about 2% of those eggs available to us. So it is still possible, but the window within which you can biologically have a child has significantly shrunk, and also the number of eggs with which you can have that child are significantly less. And the quality of those eggs have also decreased. And the problem is that now, as women have gained more agency in their lives over the past generation or two, we're more accomplished, we look better. You know, one of the doctors I interviewed, Dr. Carol Kowalczyk of Michigan, she said, you know, 40 is the new 30, but our eggs are not following.
So what do we do with this information? So I was thinking about what I wanted to ask you. I'm 33. I have no children, want to have children. And I was thinking maybe I'll ask her for advice. And then I thought that would be so presumptuous of her to give me advice about what to do. So how did you thread the needle on that? I mean, What are women to do?
Well, I end the book with action items for the future. And I'm not an expert. I have my own personal story. I've tried to connect it to the bigger picture by presenting multiple points of view, both from experts and women around the country. And what I came up with are some very specific suggestions for how people can educate themselves. What I hope for the book is that it's a conversation starter and a policy changer. And when I say conversation starter, it's for people to really have conversations with their doctors, with their peers, with their partners, and to really explore the fertility basics and how better informed we can be and how that better information can help us make better decisions for the future. Like, I don't think that anyone's to blame. I don't think that feminism's to blame. I don't think that the medical establishment is to blame. But I think that we made the decisions we made based on the information we had. And how can we look at that information and improve it so that we can make better decisions in the future? And if I were to give you advice as a friend, not as an expert, I mean, I would encourage you to talk to your doctor. But as a friend, I would say to really educate yourself about the fertility basics, and there are very simple ways in which you can do that. They're all online and virtual. Looking at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, they have incredible data sheets that give you all the statistics and ways in which you can educate yourself.
But I have a friend who's an OBGYN. I was reading your book, and I say, what? Okay, so your book mentions egg inventories, and one of the kind of paradoxes of dealing with infertility and fertility is you don't necessarily know as a woman if you have an issue until you start trying. So if you have waited until 35 to start trying, then you're finding out later that you might have been better off starting at 30. But to go to a doctor and say, I'm 30. I don't really know if I want to have kids in the next 5 years. What can you tell me? The egg inventory, my friend who's an OBGYN said, it's too expensive. We don't usually do it until a woman has issues with fertility.
Well, and that is where the policy change has to happen. Because, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, we don't teach ourselves to read and write. And when it comes to sex education, I feel like we're expected to wing it too much, and we find out too much about the fertility basics and the basic information about men's and women's biologies only after they become a problem. And I feel like we have to deal proactively with our fertilities. And I feel like the starting point at which we know our fertility basics has to move up. So sex education, for instance, shouldn't just be about preventing pregnancies and STDs. We should also be educated about the span of our fertility so that we have it in our heads as we're making decisions as we get older. And one of the hopes that I have for the book is that young people read it, because I feel like they're my target audience, along with women of reproductive ages and women and men who are facing these decisions. Because I think if you're thinking about your fertility basics as you get older, then it'll help you make better decisions in your 20s and 30s. And there are simple tests that you can do to check, for instance, your ovarian reserve. You can get your AMH tested through a simple blood test. The problem that happens with policy is that insurance often doesn't cover those tests. And I think that has to change. These tests are not invasive. They're very simple. We are covered for things like mammograms, pap smears, colonoscopies, all things that help us determine any underlying issues and help us be healthier individuals. I think that testing our fertilities should also be covered.
One of the things you write a lot about is the mixed messages that sort of come at women just sort of walking through American society in 2014. And of course, the biological clock is something that's kind of always been around, that the tick, 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 and this idea that women have to be mindful of time. But then you look at, you know, celebrity tabloid magazines, and the ages of women having children is increasing there. And what you don't hear a lot about are the women who maybe tried to start at 38, 39 and weren't successful. In researching this book, what did you find out about that silence?
I was amazed to discover how many people, as I conducted the interviews, had a story about infertility or miscarriage to tell, whether it was their own or a friend's. And it struck me how silent we are around these issues. And my hope for the book is that it strips away the guilt that women feel about them so that they are more open about it. And one of the best reactions I've gotten to the book is that people feel like it's healed them about their own guilt and that it helps them talk about it with other people. And I feel like when it comes to how people have children, it's a very private and personal matter, and celebrities aren't under any obligation to tell us how they do it. But I think that they do a disservice when they conceal their own struggles because they can inspire other people to open up. Like, for instance, when Beyoncé and Jay-Z talk about having a miscarriage, it helps other people talk about miscarriage. And I feel like in sharing my story, because I don't want to give too much away because I want people to read the book, but there are so many plot twists and turns, some of which were quite devastating to me personally. But I feel like by sharing those, then I give the reader something to connect to, and maybe it'll help them feel better about themselves.
One of the things you mentioned in the book that I thought was so striking is someone observed the difference between a cancer treatment waiting room and a IVF fertility treatment waiting room. That in a cancer treatment room, you have a lot of swapping stories and tips and this sense of, oh, how are you getting through this and what are you doing to deal with this? And in an IVF waiting room, there's silence and averted eyes. Not a lot of that swapping of stories.
And that was my personal experience. I talk about the day that I walk into the fertility center, and everyone was looking down. And I thought, how unfortunate that so many people in the same boat, having the same experiences, are not connecting with each other. You know, we are all survivors in a sense, too. But I think it's because there is such shame around these issues, because you're dealing with such personal, subjective, emotionally loaded pursuits, the pursuit of having a child. And people have very strong reactions to that. And I've definitely found that around the book, both kind of for and against. And I think that by opening up this conversation, I hope that people start connecting more and looking up.
And in that spirit, we're going to take some of your calls. Mickey in Manhattan, what's your story?
Yes. Hello, ladies.
Hi. Welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you. I'm a 42-year-old woman, and I got married later in life. I didn't marry until I was 36 and thought I had, you know, plenty of time, like many of the women that you're discussing. And my husband and I took our first year, did not start trying, and we've been trying since I was about 38. And I had two rounds of IUI, and I went to one of the best infertility.
And IUI, explain what that means?
I'm going to put it in very layman's terms. It's when the sperm is introduced into the womb, and there's a hope and a prayer that it will connect with the it will connect with your ovum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a little help. It isn't a lot of medication, but I did try those because there was no sign of any other real fertility issues for me. I had been tested, you know, had run the gamut of tests. There really had been no other issues other than my age. And then I moved on and I had my first IVF treatment, in vitro fertilization, and that was unsuccessful. I was able to get pregnant naturally once, and then I miscarried at 9 weeks. And then I waited a few months. I had another IVF cycle, and that was unsuccessful. And then I waited a few months, and I got pregnant naturally, and I had another miscarriage. And now I'm 42, and my IVF specialist has pretty much told me that there really is nothing that they can do for me because I don't have any real infertility abnormalities. It's really just age. It's just the fact that I waited too late. You know, I thought that I had more time, and my fertility clock has run out, and I wish I would have had access to this information, you know, 10, you know, even 15 years ago, so that I could have made some other choices or at least made a more informed choice. So I'm very happy to hear that, you know, unfortunately for the two of us, that you know, this is the case. I'm really happy to hear that you've taken the time to compile this this data and make it available, because I think that our younger women really need to know that, you know, career is important, but you cannot put off having a family if it's a goal.
Thanks so much for your call, Mickey. I appreciate hearing your story. One thing she mentioned there that you bring up is once you get into this sort of, you're running the gamut of trying to get pregnant, and you're coming up against unsuccessful IVF treatments, miscarriages, there's this sense of trying to take a few weeks to mourn and then get right back at it. I mean, what was that like emotionally to go through knowing you still had this time pressure while you're going through these very devastating circumstances?
Well, it's an emotional roller coaster that no one prepared me for and that it's impossible to prepare yourself for. And the experiences that you go through when you're in the world of infertility is, it's truly devastating, and I think it's something that people shouldn't feel they're alone with, and that's what I hope the book does. You know, there's a great blurb that I was fortunate Christy Turlington Burns gave me this blurb in sharing There Can Also Be Healing when she talked about the big lie, and that's one of the things I really hope for. And also, the big lie isn't just about infertility, but it really is about encouraging people to put themselves boldly into the future that they envision for themselves, and also to stop pitching ourselves against the judgments and expectations of others, and also for people to embrace the multiplicity of ways in which people build families. And there's so much pressure on women, especially, to have biological children, and we really need to be opening up the discussion so that people are thinking about avenues like adoption, surrogacy, egg donation, etc.
I'm speaking with Tanya Selvaratnam about the pros and cons of waiting to start a family. Her book is The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. It's published by Prometheus Books. We'll be back with more of your calls after the break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. I'm speaking with Tanya Selvaratnam. Her book, The Big Lie, sorts through a lot of the conflicting messages about delaying pregnancy and what it means for fertility. I want to ask you about, you're talking about opening up the conversation about infertility, the struggles of older women to get pregnant. What's the polite way to try to open that conversation when you really don't know whether people are looking to start a family, whether they've chosen not to have children? How have you managed that socially?
I think, like, for many of us, it feels like an order, you know, don't delay. It's time for you to settle down. Like, our mothers tell us, you know, when are you going to give us grandkids? And it feels very imposing. It feels like it's threatening our independence. And I think if we open up the conversation so that we're asking people questions like, do you envision yourself having a family? How do you see yourself making that possible? Do you want to have a career? How can you achieve balance between your career and parenthood? What does happiness mean for you? You know, really asking people questions rather than giving them orders, I think, is a way to normalize the discourse. And I definitely think people sharing their stories more so that we hear not just the success stories, but also the struggles, is really important to balance them out. Because the truth is, fertility issues can happen at any age in the spectrum. It's just that as you get older, the statistics, the number of people that will have issues do increase. But these issues affect people across the generation. So I want to see more intergenerational dialogue happen too.
We're also taking your calls. Call in with your story about age and childbearing, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Pamela in Hoboken, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you so much.
What's your story?
I have so much to say about this conversation, but I want to just thank you for having it. I am one of those people that had a child at 30, 35, and 40. I did IVF 5 times, had 2 or 3 miscarriages. But, you know, not until I met my third in vitro doctor did he tell me that my eggs weren't good quality and that I should live like a diabetic, go on diabetes medicine, eat like a diabetic, and he could improve the quality of my eggs, which is why I have my second and third child, because I was able to get pregnant on my second, for my second child, and also I had good enough eggs to make extra embryos to freeze so that my 5-year-old and 10-year-old are actually fraternal twins. And I'm always shocked. I mean, if I could wear a T-shirt saying I did IVF, come talk to me, I would. But people are so secretive about it, and they're so they don't talk about it, and I don't understand why.
Well, thanks,
and I
thanks so much for your call, Pamela and Hoboken.
Sure.
But that's so interesting. Your 5-year-old and 10-year-old are fraternal twins.
Yeah, and actually, it's factually true. I didn't even need an amnio for my 5-year-old because the IVF doctor said she was a 34-year-old egg.
Huh. Thank you so much for your story. I want to ask you, Tanya, about IVF and money.
Oh, yes.
For women who are considering whether to take that step when you don't know if it's going to be successful, what is something you need to know about the amount of money it's going to take, insurance coverage, and how it ranges in different states? What do women need to know?
Well, it's impossible to separate the discussion of delaying motherhood and infertility from the economics of it globally. And that was something that there's a whole chapter that talks about the global landscape of infertility where I deal with the economics in The Big Lie. But I think people should educate themselves about what kind of cost they can anticipate. An IVF cycle will cost anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000, and it will often take multiple rounds. As this caller said, she went through 5 rounds, multiple rounds, so you're looking in the tens and tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if you live in one of the 15 states that mandate some type of fertility coverage, then you're lucky, but most of America doesn't.
Does that include New York?
New York is, and actually the list is quite surprising. It includes Arkansas, Hawaii, Illinois, Texas, Montana, New York and New Jersey. But there are most of the states in America do not cover it. And this, to me, is one of the inherent injustices of the way we deal with infertility and childbearing in this country, that where you live and how much you make can really determine whether or not you can pursue having a child. And there were statistics recently from the Department of Agriculture that showed it costs about $235,000 to raise a child for the first 17 years. When you factor in infertility and fertility treatments, that cost becomes exorbitant. And most people can't deal with it. So it's we know that people are choosing not to have children in much higher numbers. That number has doubled in about a generation. But we need to factor in how many people are choosing not to have children because they can't afford to.
Any sense of how many women in that number who are choosing not to have children, it's because of confronting fertility difficulties and deciding that it's okay not to have kids?
Well, I think as the callers have said, you know, there is so much silence on these issues that it's almost impossible to quantify. But one of the things I talk about in the book, there's a whole chapter called Friends with Kids and Friends Without in The Big Lie, where I interview women who have chosen not to have kids, who had kids when they were in their 20s, who had kids when they were in their 30s or 40s, some of whom didn't have kids by choice, some of whom didn't have kids by circumstance. And what I was surprised to find out is that there were a number of people who were very good friends of mine, whom I thought were totally successful career women who had just chosen that path not to have children. But what I found is that quite a few of them had an opportunity to have a child at one point, and it didn't work out, meaning that they had miscarriages, unsuccessful infertility treatments, or marriages that didn't work out. So it's impossible to quantify, but there are a multiplicity of stories within that spectrum. So we also have to acknowledge the women who don't have children and don't want to, but the reasons that they don't have them are various.
Liz in Brooklyn, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show. What is your story?
Hi, I heard so many things that really click with my story as well. I have 2 or 3, depending on how you count it, reasons why I delayed. One is I'm a surgeon and went through a lot of residency training and didn't feel like I could have a child at that time. 2 is my husband has a spinal cord injury. We knew we would have to have IVF or some sort of assisted fertility. And 3, the money to do that. And so I had my first child at 40, right after my birthday. And we did go through one failed cycle that ended in miscarriage. But my 2 boys were actually conceived on the same day as well, but they were born 20 months apart.
And how old is your oldest child now?
He is 6 and a half.
6 and a half. So what's been your experience of becoming a mom at age 40 and raising your kids in your 40s, raising little kids in your 40s?
Well, you know, most of the time it seems just normal, except when I meet up with friends who had kids 10 years ago. And then it just seems, you know, just completely out of whack and strange that they are so far ahead in that one aspect of life. You know, that they have kids going to college or, you know, in high school already, and I feel like I just kind of got started.
Thanks so much for your call, Liz. Tanya, I have a question about partners. And you've talked about wanting to make sure that you hope young women are a big part of the audience that you reach with this book, women who are not yet experiencing difficulty with their fertility because of age. What are some talking points for partners about saying, this is important to me, this is what I know I want to do in the next 5 to 10 years, this is my timeline, and how do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's important, and in the book I deal with my own relationship issues that emerged over the course of trying to have a child. And it set me off on this whole investigation into the impact of infertility and childbearing on relationships. And this is another conversation that
it's
people
kind of big.
It's huge. It's huge, the number of people that I've spoken to whose marriages or relationships fell apart during this process. And I feel like some of those minefields could have been prevented if people had talked proactively about their goals with their partners. And again, it's like encouraging people not to be scared of the conversation, like be unafraid and be curious. And don't assume that somebody else is in line with your vision for the future, even if they're in love with you, you know, to really have those conversations. And there are one of the things I'm doing is developing a toolkit that I'm going to launch next week that I'll make available for a free download. And in that, I'm going to have a whole list of questions that I've culled from people I've interviewed for how people can start those conversations. And I think it's really be curious about the other person in your life and have fun with it, you know?
So at this point, you had 3 miscarriages. We haven't talked about your later cancer diagnosis. But where are you in your choices about deciding to become a parent right now?
Well, I like that you said you felt like you were along with me for the ride, because what happened as I started writing the book, you know, I started writing it after my 3rd miscarriage in the fall of 2011. And then it was before I knew what I was going to do. And then I ended up pursuing fertility treatments. I went to an IVF center and I was lucky to have insurance that covered it. And I was greenlit for insurance, and on the day that an IVF cycle was starting, a growth was detected. And I want people to read the book to see, but it is quite suspenseful. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I realized that I was not the only woman who had underlying medical conditions revealed through the process of fertility treatments. Juliana Rancic, the television host, is a great example of somebody who's done a lot to educate people about these issues, because her breast cancer was discovered through that. But it set me on this different roller coaster than pursuing having a child. I had to save my own life. So somehow the silver lining for me was that in the process of trying to make a new life, I found out that I had to save my own, and I was lucky enough to be able to do that. I was diagnosed with just cancer and thymoma. And then I also had problems with my relationship, which is where, and today I'm alone. And it's just been a year since I went through the experiences that I document in the book. They happened very much in real time as I was writing. The book helped me. I say that it helped me write myself out of the belly of the whale. Mm. And also, I'm lucky that I'm an artist, because I believe that when life gives you lemons, if you're an artist, you make art. So that's what I did. Right now, where I am is I'm still very much healing from that experience. But I'm also very happy with where I am in my life, and I'm happy to share this book with the world. I'm happy with the conversations that are starting around this book, and I hope that it helps people, whether they agree with me or not. Like, I think the debate is necessary.
Tanya Selvaratnam is the author of The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. It's published by Prometheus Books. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.